hypnotic technique?
Yeah, I used it since I was a little girl.
Well, what have you learned from Ion since you knew that? What other stuff have you learned from Ion?
Well, I knew that too, that you make your own reality, and you can't blame anybody for if you have a bad way to go because you called it out there. You put it out there, and you're the only one that can change it. A lot of people blame people for things. And it's not anybody else's
fault. Ion seems to be, I'm not sure if Ion says that, seems to be saying that for 5 years. So we know that. You knew it before. So what have you learned from Ion that you didn't know?
What do I learn? I don't know. I've done a lot of these things for a long time. The only thing is I can't seem to... I didn't learn it yet. He said I can do it, but I still haven't done it. Manifesting different things just to come through the ethers in my house that I've wanted. Like when I, at the moment, noticed if I want AS, steak dinner with all the fixings. It hasn't happened yet. He said it's right at my door, but I'm not letting it in. I'm trying to figure out how to let it in.
Well, can't you just speak it?
I spoke it, but it hasn't come in the door. I mean, I'm not talking about ordering it. I'm talking about just saying it, and it's here.
Yeah, you said it, so it should come.
Yeah, that hasn't happened yet. That I'm having a little trouble with, which is something I'm just trying to do. And I'm not saying
so there's another factor.
Yeah, something's missing, because I believe it can happen. It just hasn't.
Yeah, so there's another factor besides the 2 points you made.
Yeah, that's the only thing I haven't been able to do yet. Because I I used to watch a lot of Bewitched, and I always loved the show, and I always thought I could do it. And now I've decided I intend to do it, but it hasn't really happened yet on those things. I mean, some things, but not the... not the dinners yet. Some things do come that I ask for, but not that.
Right. You're asking for a dinner?
Yes, I'm asking for a steak dinner just to appear. When I want it just to appear, whatever it is. I'm thinking if I'm hungry, because I like to, when I'm on the show, I'm always hungry. So just... I'd like to order that because I'm staying home, and I'd like a really good steak dinner.
You don't want to pay for it?
No, I want it to come through the ethers in my house. I mean,
just show up on your table.
Right.
So Ion has not helped you create that possibility.
He told me that it's right at my door. I just have to let it in. But I haven't figured out how to do that yet. How to let it in that it really does come in my house.
Well, why wouldn't you ask Ion how to do it?
Maybe I'll ask him. He just said I had to open up to letting it in because I look out the door and it's not there. It's not outside my door.
Could ask Ion how to do it.
I think I could ask him because I think he thinks I know how to do it. Or I'm blocking something and I'm trying to figure out what I'm blocking. Because I've done other things.
Would you admit you didn't know how to do it?
Well, I've asked for it. I believe it can happen. It's not that I don't believe it. I believe a lot of things can happen that people never did that I always did. But this hasn't happened yet. I believe it can happen.
So, Bert, you didn't hear the Bruce Lipton part about belief.
No. No, I did not.
Yeah,
I tuned in. I heard.
You know, Renee thinks that believing it's going to happen is going to help. Didn't I on...
Well, it doesn't.
He said you have to
be...
see it before you believe it.
Oh,
he
I don't
you have
to
see it.
No. Yeah, you see it in your mind's eye. And you know it's there. I don't have to believe it. I could be phrasing it wrong because I just know it can be. I'm just wondering when it'll show up because it hasn't yet.
Well, you believe it. You see it in your mind's eye. You believe it. It should show up.
It should. I'm going to try a few different things and see if that's what it's waiting for, because I thought it should come in their own dishes. Maybe I need to put my dishes out, too.
Hmm. Well, the next thing to do is to read Alan Cabal. His statement today. Where is it?
Wow, did I luck out, Bob? You haven't read Cabal yet? You must have been busy last night.
No, I've read it. It's, oh, there it is. I have to find it. I've got a whole bunch of stuff on my bar. So,
you read it
Alan
Cabal's already?
I read it 24 hours ago, 22 hours ago, something like that. Because it's published on Fridays. Friday morning, so...
Oh, you read it. Okay. You haven't read it on the air yet, though.
No,
usually
no,
earlier.
No. So,
good for me.
Alan Cabal... Beg your pardon?
I said, good for me. I didn't miss it this time. I've missed many weeks
okay.
in the past here.
Right. So, I will mute everybody.
All participants are now muted.
So this is called The Delusion of Wealth, subtitled The Inevitable Tsunami is Coming Soon. It says, I'm spending more time with animals than people lately. They're getting comfortable with me. A rabbit came up to me today, 3 feet away, and just hung out while I smoked a joint. The squirrels are coming closer. The endless serenade of the birds grows more robust. Their swoops and flutters more daring. The woodchucks lumber around like they own the place. I sit out back here, still on the porch, smoking, drinking, gazing over the ancient trees and the meadow with its copses and their secrets, and the grassy knoll. Sometimes I go inside and watch broadcast television news. I haven't watched it in at least a decade. It's hilarious. The wheels are coming off the attempted New World Order in quotes. Since the presumed death of communism with the collapse of the Soviet Union, radical capitalism has run amok on a global scale. Bruce Springsteen phrased it well in his song Badlands. Quote, all men want to be rich. Rich men want to be king. King ain't satisfied until he's king of everything. Unquote. The fundamental flaw in contemporary capitalist reasoning is that the elite are rich because they're smart. It's the lie from which all of their delusions spring. They see themselves as philosopher kings in the Platonic sense. Having amassed their great fortunes, they attempt to reshape the world according to their own myopic vision of what the world should be based on the conceit that the acquisition of inconceivable personal wealth somehow qualifies them to dictate public policy. They are wrong in all counts. There is a demonstrable inverse relationship between personal wealth and practical intelligence. Simply put, the rich pay other people to do their thinking for them. It's like using a calculator to do basic arithmetic or using autodial to make phone calls. Eventually, you lose the capacity to perform basic calculations in your head or remember phone numbers. I'd love to see a social experiment in which billionaires are placed in an urban environment for 6 months with no access to their money and forced to live by their wits. I wonder how well Jeff Bezos or Larry Ellison would do scrambling for a minimum wage job at some convenience store or fast food joint, sharing a one-bedroom apartment with two other people living on food stamps. My guess would be suicide in less than 8 weeks. The real kicker is that the wealth in quotes, possessed by these creatures is utterly intangible. It exists solely in cyberspace. Any one of them could be impoverished by a few lines of code, an algorithm executed by a bored teenager living in a Florida double-wide while a single mom is out busting her ass waiting tables at a local diner. They don't really own anything, own in quotes. They don't really own anything. Nestle chairman Peter Brabeck Letmathy has openly stated that access to water is not a human right. And Fermi believes that his company owns water rights all over the globe by virtue of having purchased those rights from corrupt politicians. He'll find out in short order who owns that water when he tries to assert that ownership. Money may very well talk, but not as loudly as a fully loaded AK-47 or an IED. More than ever before, the concept of ownership in quotes, the concept of ownership is a hoax. More than ever before, the concept of ownership is a hoax. Communism isn't dead. It's just resting, letting radical capitalism have enough rope. They aren't rich because they're smart. They're rich because they don't play by the rules. They're utterly corrupt, and so far they've been very lucky. Read that again. They aren't rich because they're smart. They're rich because they don't play by the rules. They're utterly corrupt, and so far they've been very lucky. That luck is running out. Already we see a resurgence of openly Nazi ideology in Greece, Spain, Ukraine, and Germany, of all places. Hitler is enormously popular in India and Southeast Asia, even in Japan. End-stage capitalism digs its own grave. The calls from the elite for austerity cuts, austerity in quotes, the calls from the elite for austerity cuts and benefits for the very poorest members of society worldwide, while the aristocracy indulges in the most obscenely flagrant displays of wealth in human history, are fueling public outrage and a resurgent communism that in no way resembles the mockery that was the CCCP. That was the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. There's a lot of pessimism around these days, but I'm very optimistic. I firmly believe that I'm going to witness the complete collapse of the oligarchy currently in power. The tide has been going out swiftly for the past 35 years. The inevitable tsunami is coming soon. Don't be on the beach when it hits. So, that last sentence, direct attack on me. Let's see.
All participants are now unmuted.
On me.
Yeah, he's getting
don't be
sort
on
of
the
gloomy.
Beach.
Don't be on the beach when it hits.
What'd you say? He's gloomy? What'd you say?
Yeah, he's getting more gloomier. I mean, last week it was interesting about his son dying. And
no,
now
he's not getting gloomy. He's saying he's getting optimistic.
Yeah.
He says there's a lot of pessimism around these days, but I'm very optimistic. I firmly believe that I'm going to witness a complete collapse of the oligarchy currently in power. The tide has been going out swiftly for the past 35 years. It's like the guff is emptying. The inevitable tsunami is coming soon. Don't be on the beach, Dobbs, when it hits. He's finally listening to our recordings. He's trying to...
You didn't talk to him this week.
No.
At all.
I never talked to him.
Before you wrote this? Yeah,
I have not talked to him. 2003 or so. No, he's listening to the recordings, and he's going to start using me as his target. I represent the 1%, the aristocracy, indulging myself. And he says, my days are numbered. I will be working as a slave in a communist environment none too quickly, or none too shortly, or however the nuns cancel the nuns, two double negatives. Never was very good at that.
complete collapse of the oligarchy currently in power.
Power. And
complete
the
collapse.
The tide's been going out swiftly. Look at that. The tide's been going out swiftly for the past 35 years. That's 1990. No, 1980. So when I surfaced in 1980, started listening to Mae Brussel tapes, the oligarchy started to weaken as my army was built. See, he's quoting, he's saying Dobbs. For 35 years, Dobbs has been eroding to create the opening to make even the most pessimistic people feel optimistic. But again, they bite the hand that feeds them and claim that I won't be able to stay on the beach. No more beach for you, Dobbs. Your happy lifestyle is coming. You may be saving the world for the last 35 years, but you've been accumulating power and autonomy and beauty, and we're not going to have it.
Yeah, you might have to go inland, Bob.
Inland? Inland Empire?
Inland. Inland Empire.
Oh.
Yes, you might. Yes, you might have to move to your empire in the middle of the country.
Did you say England? You were saying I might have to go to England?
No,
no, I said inland, inland. Like you might have to move to the center. You might have to move to the center of the country rather than being on the beach, out on the
inland,
island.
Inland, not inland, not inland.
Correct.
Inland. I'm going to have to go inland. Inland.
Inland.
Maybe Michigan say that. Inland. Okay, so there you have it. What do you think of that, Bert? Alan Cabal. He's sort of starting to get happy.
Okay, yes. So he must have listened to a tape, or maybe someone has leaked and tuned in and gave him a little information.
No, he started watching broadcast news. He started watching broadcast news, found it quite enjoyable, quite hilarious. I will not say that he's listening to me. I will just make up a pattern that if he was, he would end up saying this. Dobbs, do not plan on staying on the beach much longer.
Move to Iowa, Dobbs.
So let's go over and see what Mugger says. We will go back, and since we have all night, nothing to present, we will try to entertain myself. I will try to entertain me in my own inimitable way. The Delusion of Wealth, Alan Cabal. So where is Mugger? Where's Mugger right? Well, we did that one. Why No One Reads Editorials. Did we read that? Yes, we did that last week. Darns, doesn't seem to be any new ones.
Who's Mugger, Bob?
He's the owner of this newspaper website.
Twice Today?
Beg your pardon? Yeah, he writes
the owner
his real name, Russ Today, yep. I assume he owns it.
Okay.
He used to own the New York Press that Alan Cabal wrote for. I don't think he could keep up. He could stop creating places for writers to work. So he created this website. Don't know if it requires any money. So we read Why No One Reads Editorials. Is that the end of his contributions?
Look here, I found an article entitled The Majesty of the Midwest.
Ah. Well, I did find a new column.
No. Sorry, never mind.
By who?
T. Smith.
Okay, so his new column seems to be The Limbo, How Low Can the Red Sox Go? Subtitle, I'm waiting for Ben Cherington bobblehead night at Fenway Park. I'm waiting for Ben Cherington bobblehead night at Fenway Park. How low can the Red Sox go? Now, I don't know much about this baseball stuff, so let's see what we can learn. He says, at what point in the baseball season do fans resign themselves to the plain fact that their team is pretty crummy and has a slim to none chance of making the playoffs? It's only June 5th, but if you're like me and root for the Red Sox, the glass is nearly empty. Worst, first, worst may not happen. But even in the devalued American League East, the Sox are playing like one of those now-forgotten Boston squads from the early 1960s. Although in 2015, that comes with a $200 million payroll. Light candles for Tony Conigliaro, Dick Raddatz, Gary Geiger, Pinky Higgins, Dick Stewart, and Bill Monboquette. I thought the low point came last Sunday when a Pablo Sandoval error led to a walk-off win by the Texas Rangers. But this season, Sox are just full of nasty surprises, evidenced by Thursday's implosion when a combination of errors, Bush base running, and lackadaisical play turned a 4-0 lead over the Twins into a really, really ugly 8-4 loss. I watched the game unravel, receiving texts from my buddy Rick every 2 minutes, and for 2 hours after felt like I was coming down from a bad acid trip. A win, rare this year, is the opposite. It's a cocaine rush, good for a short period, and then it's back to business. My mood was sour, thinking about Sandoval, that damn panda making a couple of more errors. Hanley Ramirez forgetting how many outs there were while on base, and how this team built to score in MLB leading runs, built to score in something leading runs, is inept at the plate. Do you have MLB? Anybody know what that is, MLB?
Major League Baseball.
Okay, built to score on Major League Baseball leading runs. That doesn't sound right. How this team built to score on... No, built to score and MLB leading runs. Okay, that means built to score and Major League Baseball leading runs? That makes sense? Leading the...
Yeah, leading runs in the... Yeah, he's displaying his leading runs in the Major League Baseball. But he's kind of wrote it out weird.
Yeah, he says, and how this team is inept at the plate. My son Booker is far more circumspect. Not dispassionate, mind you, just grounded in reality. And told me that the season is at the 1/3 mark in Boston's record thus far is a small sample size. At 5.5 games off the pace, the Sox can't be written off yet, he said. Though the article he wrote a week ago says otherwise. He wrote a week ago. Who is that? Did Booker write? Yeah, Booker Smith. Booker Smith, the young guy. Here's why the Red Sox are in trouble. General manager Ben Cherington repeatedly proves why he doesn't deserve his job. So he's complaining like his father about these important issues in the leisure society. Okay, so at 5.5 games off the pace, the Sox can't be written off yet, he said, though the article he wrote a week ago says otherwise. So he's catching his son being inconsistent. Mugger says, I follow a lot of Sox fans on Twitter. Imagine that, following baseball fans on Twitter. Where this guy is obviously a rich person. He's on the beach. He's going to get nailed. He's obviously going to be not going to be able to sit around doing that much longer. I follow a lot of Sox fans on Twitter, and not surprisingly, after this latest turd Sandoval and company left in our pockets, the reaction was nearly hysterical. Boiled down, the consensus was, fire everyone. The fans are demanding everybody to be fired. Too bad it's not so easy, since owner John Henry isn't going anywhere. Even though his pocket will be picked for the remainder of the seasons as attendance suffers and TV ratings dwindle. And apparently the architect of this underachieving crew, general manager Ben Cherington, has a job for life. Instead, my bet is that manager John Farrell will be the next sacrificial lamb. Pitching coach Juan Neves was let go earlier this year, which is neither here nor there to me. Aside from bullpen decisions, a manager's job is overrated. But if Farrell is replaced, maybe by Jason Veritek, groomed for a manager's job, well, that'll spark some interest for about a week. Let's see, a manager's overrated. Farrell, who's Farrell? Manager, is that manager John Farrell will be the next sacrificial lamb. Aside from bullpen decisions, the manager's job is overrated, but if Farrell's replaced, he'll have a little spark, but only for about a week. God only knows why Charrington signed Ramirez and Sandoval during the offseason, and he ain't telling. Granted, hardly anyone thought Ramirez would turn out to be the worst left fielder in Sox history, so bad that when he actually catches a ball, there's an audible sigh from the fans at Fenway Park and in living rooms around the country. And here's the really bad news. Worse than Charrington screwing up the draft on Monday, probably squandering his number 7 pick on a guy who'll never make it out of AA. All right, here's the really bad news for Sox fans. Come trading deadline, the Sox are screwed. They have nothing to sell. Who'd want Sandoval, Ramirez, Craig Breslow, Alexi Ogando, D.L. Hobbled, Shane Victorino, or Joe Kelly? And no spot on the roster for an offensive upgrade. A trade for Cole Hamels hardly makes any sense at this point. Sure, a decent pitcher would help, but the team's main problem is hitting and catching the ball. Excuse me. So, barring an unexpected winning streak of 10 games, for this Red Sox fan, it's early call for anyone but the Yankees. So he's, Mugger is saying, anyone but the Yankees. Man, am I sick of that. Yes, do that every year. Anyone but the Yankees. So,
have you ever watched a baseball game, Bob?
Not in 60 years. I might have watched one in the 50s when I first came here and was curious about the strange version of soccer where people didn't move. They just stood there. What was the point? Imagine standing. I can't stand in some spot for more than 10 minutes. These guys just stand there for hours. How do they do it?
Yeah, it's a boring game. It's a boring.
Damn right. Boring. So boring. And I was interested. I love that story. I'm standing in the candy store. I think I've told it before. 1960 or 61, walking along near Sullivan's Pond in downtown Dartmouth. And I walked into the Boomer's little store. Boomer ran it, Mr. Boomer. We called them Boomers or something. And, oh, there were all these little kids, like, you know, grade 3, 4, and 5, standing and it was probably cold out because it gets cold early in Nova Scotia. So it was in October or something. And these kids were standing wrapped listening to Mr. Boomer's radio. So I had never experienced so many little kids in my presence in previous years of working with Project Paperclip and bringing in Nazis to ruin your country. You know, a chance to hang out with kids. I have gone down to bus stations and pretend I was leaving, but that's about how much time I had to do something. So I could only do that for about 22 minutes. I had to get the hell back to the office. And fucking, Reinhard Gehlen was freaking out because it wasn't like Germany. It wasn't like Berlin. And where was Adolf? And how did Adolf let him down? I had to calm him down and say, just keep track of the Soviet intelligence on the Eastern Front.
Gosh, I think the question was, have you ever watched a baseball game?
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, it's good to try to get some participation going here. It looks like I have to be the whole show. I have to provide my own humor. Yeah, keep going. So I'm standing there with all these little children, and it's the ninth inning, and it's a tie game or something, and the tension is incredible. And all of a sudden, Bill Mazeros or somebody from Baltimore or some crazy team from some little town that I'd never been in.
The Minnesota Twins,
the Green Bay Packers. Maybe it was a bunch of all Canadians. I don't know who it was. Maybe it was who are we talking to here?
Red Sox.
Bert. See, I just forget where I am. I can't even remember who my audience is. Maybe Bert's father was catcher for some team out of Florida, Miami Dolphins or something. So anyways, I'm standing there. And Jesus Christ, it's like, what do they used to say? Bottom of the ninth, 3-2, right? Is it 3-2?
Yeah.
And then the next ball, it can be a four, a walk, or a strike. Well, the guy pitches it, and the damn mill, Bill Mazeroski, hits the fucking thing, and it goes and goes and goes and goes, and the kids are starting to leap about, and it's chopping on my feet. I'm trying to eat a chocolate bar, not Snickers. They didn't make them back then. I don't know what it was, a fucking cherry blossom or something. I used to like cherry blossoms back in 1960. Wonderful liquid. And so the ball's going, going, going. Even Mr. Boomer's smiling. You can't, but this Mr. Boomer, a few years later, his son died, drowned. So Boomer was a rather dour guy, knowing things like that were happening to him in his life eventually, sad point. But he started smiling.
The ball's still in the air.
I was just, holy shit, man. This is incredible. I'm witnessing American culture in action, even though it was in Canada. Actually, on the border of Canada, right on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean, with statues of Winston Churchill in the local park. But anyways, we thought with television we could be part of it. And so the ball went into the stands, and the Bill Mazeroski rounded the plates. What do you have? Plates, one, two, first, second, third, back home. Everybody's going nuts. And it was a good day. Nobody called a foul. It was a home run. They won the World Championship, the World Series, and we never heard from them again. Next year, Roger Maris dominated with his challenging of Babe Ruth's record, or maybe it was even that year. And then the Beatles came, and all fell apart, and nobody remembered baseball. So that was the last. I was there for the last final act of baseball, the last thrilling moment.
Well,
and I'm happy to report it to my audience, my loyal audience.
The one and only game you saw.
Yes.
Changed the world.
The one I saw. It was the best
again.
Way. I saw little kids being deluded by the Android meme, believing that life could be a victory. Some lucky guy is going to hit the ball out of the park for you, and you will not have to atone. Of course, all those kids grew up, flunked out of college, flunked out of high school, started working in local factories, got married, got divorced, got cancer, and died. And Bill Mazeroski never came around again to make their life worth living. But the guy that was going to change it for their grandkids stood among them, yours truly. And I was going to make a better world for their grandchildren. But little did they know, and little did I know, but that's the joke of life. All great jokes lead to great art. How was that? That was
pretty
cool. That was quite a rant.
That was good. You evoked a good one there. Just over.
Yeah.
Just over a baseball game.
Let's see.
That's all.
Yeah, let's look it up and see how close I was. Baltimore wins World Series. It will go for 1960. What's it say? List of World Series champions. Okay, so we scroll down, get to see 1960. Pittsburgh Pirates, New York Yankees. Could it have been Pittsburgh Pirates beating the Yankees? New York Yankees beat the Cincinnati Reds? Maybe it was the Cincinnati Reds. So we have to go back and type it in, 1960 World Series. No, it doesn't look like it. They don't say it's fantastic. I remember reading. So, 1961 World Series. I remember looking up this once before.
Is it in the fall? In the fall, late summer?
Mm. Oh, no, yeah. No, it's just, I know it's an awesome game, so what? Couldn't have been 1962. What am I missing? I don't think it happened. I think it was in a parallel world. This 1960, what am I writing? Greatest World Series ever. Bill Mazeroski. Let's see what that name brings up. Mazeroski. Greatest game. Greatest World Series. You know, it's costing me $20 an hour, you know. Lucky I'm rich, so I can just write it off. It looks like it's the 1960 World Series. So let's see. The 1960 World Series was played between the Pittsburgh Pirates and the New York Yankees from October 5th to October 13, 1960. It is most notable for the Game 7 ninth inning home run hit by Bill Mazeroski. I did live it. Winning the game for the Pirates 10-9 and also winning them their third World Championship overall and the first one since 1925. The World Series featured seven past, present, or future league most valuable players. The Pirates had Dick Groat and Robert Clemente, while the Yankees had five, Yogi Berra, Bobby Shantz, Mickey Mantle, Mickey Mantle's on my chart, Roger Maris, and Elston Howard. As noted in the superstition called the X-Cub Factor, this was the only series after 1945 and until 2001 in which a team with three or more former members of the Chicago Cubs was able to win a World Series. So this is the only series to team. Look, it's amazing, these statistics these guys come up with, in which a team with three or more former members of the Chicago Cubs was able to win. So if you have a team with a lot of ex-Chicago Cubs on your team, you're doomed. You're not going to win a World Series. Ex-Cub factor. Let's see, Game 7. How they describe this. Mazeroski, okay. Ralph Terry returned to the mound in the bottom of the ninth. So here it is. Like I said, it was the bottom of the ninth. What was the score? Is it 9-9? Yes. Some guy raced home to tie the score, 9-9. Had Mantle been out on the play, the run would still have counted if it had scored before the tag. With Mantle safe, the top of the ninth continued, but ended when the next batter hit into a forced play. So, first was Ricky not getting the count. Whether it stood in the Mantle, seeing he had no chance to beat it, played second, scurried back to first and avoided Nelson's tag. Had Mantle been out on the play, the run would have still counted if it had scored. Came in on in the ninth to try to protect the lead. Trying to figure out who ran. With Mantle safe, the top of the ninth continued, but ended when the next batter hit into a forced play. So it looked like the Yankees could have won the top of the ninth. Pirates had a 9-7 lead, so that means the Yankees had to tie them. So it's tie game, 9-9. So Ralph Terry for the Yankees returned to the mound in the bottom of the ninth. The first batter to face him was Bill Mazeroski. With a count of one ball and no strikes, it wasn't 3-2. One ball, no strikes. The Pirates' second baseman smashed a historic long drive over the left field wall, ending the contest and crowning the Pirates as World Series. So that was it. The ninth lasted about a minute. The bottom of the ninth, one ball, no strikes. So it's like the second pitch. Over. As the Pirates erupted, the Yankees stood across the field in stunned disbelief. Dobbs was nowhere to be seen. Dobbs was rumored to have rigged the game, but Dobbs was nowhere to be found. Dobbs had an alibi. He had an advanced futuristic videotape of himself standing in a little store with a bunch of children up in nowhere land north of Canada. Where did he get that video camera? That's what started the legend of Bob Dobbs and how he just blacklisted everybody and kept winning, kept pulling off the biggest crimes in history, and no one could ever catch Dobbs. And we're now sitting here on Sunday, June 7th, 2015, waiting for Dobbs' biggest crime, the perfect crime, to be pulled off as he distracts his listeners with silly babblings about a non-existent youth he'd ever had that he ripped off from reading some cartoon by Mugger or Alan Cabal 15 years ago. Anyways, as the Pirates erupted, the Yankees stood across the field in stunned disbelief. The improbable champions were outscored. The Pittsburgh Pirates were outscored, outhit, and outplayed, but had managed to pull out a victory anyhow. Years later, Mickey Mantle was quoted in Ken Burns' documentary Baseball as saying that losing the 1960 series was the only loss, amateur or professional, he cried actual tears over. For Bill Mazeroski, by contrast, his series-clinching home run was the highlight of a Hall of Fame career otherwise noted mostly for excellent defense. Mazeroski became the first player to hit a game-ending home run in the seventh game to win a World Series. See, it never happened before. Well, it did, but no, yeah, the first guy to win a game-ending home run in the seventh game to win a World Series. That whole fantasy of hitting a home run in the end, you know, in the final game, in the final pitch, never happened before. This is why it stands out. He did it. You get that?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. The fantasy of every kid is the, you know, the bottom of the. I remember, you know, hearing kids, you'd stand and watch them playing baseball. And they'd be yelling, okay, it's the bottom of the ninth. Bill Mazeroski's up in the plate. Well, he wouldn't say a name, but they'd tell him, bottom of the ninth, the pitch is in, boom, home run. That was the fantasy, right? And to win the series with your hit. 33 years later, Joe Carter would become the only other player to end the World Series with a home run, doing so for the Toronto Blue Jays in the 1993 World Series against the Pirates, in-state rivals, the Philadelphia Phillies, albeit in Game 6. Although most noted for the series-ending homer, Game 7 is also the only game in all of postseason history with no strikeouts recorded by either side. What does that mean? Most noted for the series-ending homer, Game 7 is also the only game in all of postseason history with no strikeouts recorded by either side. All Game 7s had content? Are they citing this thing where the Toronto Blue Jays? Or are they talking about Mazeroski? This is quite an interesting game. Bobby Richardson of the Yankees was named most valuable player of this incredible series, the only time that someone from the defeated team has been so honored. The Pirates were so bad that they couldn't even have a most valuable player for the winning series. See, this is the neat thing. The losers did it for once. This is why this game is historic. Now we're coming to our moral.
This is a parallel to you because nobody has recognized your importance in your field or fields. You know, you haven't gotten the recognition all these years. The loser wins.
Yes, that's it. This is the meeting. Very good, Gene. This is why I was there to witness the archetypal loser scenario, because I would become the biggest fucking loser in history that would hit the home run in the final living water press conference, bread of life, cold play.
And it's up. And it's out. And it's out of the ballpark. Out of the field.
World is saved by the nobody. The lousy
he's got corner third base, and he's headed to home base.
Get a Wikipedia. Couldn't even get a Wikipedia entry.
He's safe on the beach.
Yes, they saved by the beach. They will write this legendary week will be written by Allison and Fine Paley will write on Deuce. Oh, I was in Wednesday and I was in traffic. And the kid delight of Bob discovering why he was the Antichrist and why he was the second coming all rolled in one, because he was Bill Mazeroski, who was just a lousy defensive bullshit player who didn't deserve to hit anything. BM, Bill Mazeroski for Bob Marshall. BM. MB. What? There must be more. Mazeroski, how many letters? Add up the letters. Where's Sandra Greenbra? Add up the letters. Is this coming to number 5 or number 8 or number 14? Wait, what's the number here? You'll know what that means when you hear the early part of the show where Greenbaugh went half-cocked about the number five. and Bob's realizing this the day that American Pharaoh won. And so you think of these Egyptian civilizations, they go for thousands of years. We're seeing the beginning today that Bill Mazeroski becomes the new postmodern, paramodern pharaoh. Bob Dobbs, the first pharaoh to inaugurate a 30,000-year dynasty. Imagine that, 30,000 years, I promise you. When I run for president, I promise every American to live at least 25,000 years. And we'll even allow four Chicago Cubs to be on our cabinet. The kitchen cabinet that Dobbs will have. The hidden Illuminati will have four Chicago Cubs. He'll defy all historical archetypes.
Of the Cubs.
Yes, I reverse every fucking curse that ever happened to anybody, especially losers. I'm getting off. I'm strutting around the floor here. Carol's sound asleep. I'm checking to see how many windows are open, how much the neighbors are hearing this rant. There is one window open, but it's in the back room. I think I'm okay. But if we hear a doorbell ring or the knock on the door, we know it's all over. I'm heading out with Mickey Mantle with tears in my eyes as I got beat by Bob Marshall, the real meaning of Bill. It should be Bill Dobzorowski. I'm suspicious of this Bill. Is it Bill of Achieve Radio? Bill, with Bill, it should be Bob Mazeroski. This is highly, I'm being duped. I think I'm going to have to play some music, sober up here. We got any music? No, Bob, you've played it all. We heard it all. 1,000 songs is enough, Bob. We're not going to play any more. Fuck that. Put on Portal. Go for the Ion Collection. Play Bessel Goodman, God Walks the Dark Hills, something we all know and love. None of your exploratory
take
stuff that Tim
Ryman.
Yeah, take me out to the ball game. Kim Ryman of Pennsylvania sends me this music every week. That's the Pennsylvania connection right there. Kim Ryman, R-E-I-M-U-N-D. Google her. Call her up. Hassle her. Say you knew me. You knew me when I was great. When I meant something. When people fought to keep me out of the Wikipedia. Those are the great days. People actually fought battles. We have the great number one, Chad. Chad was there. He fought the good fight on behalf of Dobbs and lost and cried. Now, missing, here's an article by Russ Smith done a few weeks ago called Missing the Point on Baltimore. I keep thinking it's Baltimore. It's not Baltimore. It's Pittsburgh. They're the guys that won. That's a lousy Pittsburgh Pirates. Pittsburgh's always was a lousy, you know, industrial place, right? Rust Belt stuff. I don't know. Do you ever hear anything? Yeah. Is it still functioning? Yeah. Like what? Is it in bad shape, Pittsburgh?
I don't know. Gene, are you aware, Pittsburgh?
I don't know either. You know, you hear about Detroit.
I think they've gone off the map. I think they've been canceled. Nobody, they don't even report on Pittsburgh anymore. Let's Google Pittsburgh and see what they say about themselves. Yes, Pittsburgh. Is that where Andy Warhol has his institute, or is that in Philadelphia? Let's see, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
It was big in steel, but China's got all that now. So,
yeah, look at this. Aside from steel, Pittsburgh has led innovations in aluminum, glass, shipbuilding, petroleum, food, sports, transportation, computing, autos, and electronics. This creative wealth placed Pittsburgh behind only New York and Chicago in corporate headquarters employment, second to New York in bank assets, and with the most U.S. stockholders per capita for much of the 20th century. America's 1980s deindustrialization laid off area blue-collar workers and thousands of downtown white-collar workers after multi-billion-dollar corporate raids relocated the longtime Pittsburgh-based world headquarters of Gulf Oil, Sunbeam, Rockwell, and Westinghouse. This status is a global industry center. That would be the Mellons. I think the Pittsburgh Mellons were Pittsburgh. It's melting pot of immigrant workers and top 10 rank among the largest U.S. cities until 1950 and metro areas until 1980, left the area with renowned museums, medical centers, parks, research centers, libraries, a vibrantly diverse cultural district, and the most bars per capita in the United States. These legacies have earned Pittsburgh the title of America's most livable city. Geez, this sounds like they're doing
well,
okay.
Well, there you go. The most bars per capita, bars in baseball or bars in sports. Well, with the
look, it's got Google, Bosch, Disney, Uber, Intel, IBM, and Apple are among 1,600 technology firms generating $20 billion in annual Pittsburgh payrolls. Boy, oh boy, it's no wonder they don't talk about it. It's all good news there, you know, and the news has to be about bad news. So this is a good story, a big story, and nobody cares. It's much good news.
But, Bob, you know, going down, all they have are the manager's offices in Pittsburgh, it sounds like. It's where all the managers of all those corporations are.
The yuppie, the virtual class. You're talking about one percenter city. It's a one percenter city. My team doesn't like that. Let's see. It's home to 68 colleges and universities. Jesus Christ, including research and development leaders, Carnegie Mellon University, University of Pittsburgh, the nation's fifth largest bank. Oh, that would be Peggy Mellon. Is that Peggy Mellon? Let's find out what that is. No? PNC Financial Services Group. Just becoming strange. I think this is the source of parallel world America. I think they are a parallel world city. They've got a major stake in the parallel world economy. The nation's fifth largest bank, 8 Fortune 500 companies, and 6 of the top 300 U.S. law firms make their global headquarters in the Pittsburgh area. Wow. While RAND, BNY Mellon, that's Bank of New York Mellon, Nova, FedEx, Bayer, and blah, 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 have regional bases that help Pittsburgh become the sixth best area for U.S. job growth.
Hmm.
A leader in environmental design, the city is home to 60 total and 10 of the world's first green buildings, while billions have been invested in the area's Marcellus Fields, a renaissance of Pittsburgh's 116-year-old film industry that boasts the world's first movie theater has grown from the long-running Three Rivers Film Festival to an influx of major productions, including Disney and Paramount offices, with the largest soundstage outside Los Angeles and New York City. Nobody knew this, right? This is all new. Pittsburgh.
That's very new for me. Oh.
It's a success story. Well, I guess it started because of Bill Mazeroski. Let's find out what happened to Bill. What did Bill, what kind of life did he have? Bill Mazeroski. Wikipedia. Born September 5th, 1936. That's Apex of Polarity Day, September 5th. We talked about that many hours ago in 1969 up in Seattle. American former Major League Baseball second baseman. I guess that's where he's a defensive guy. Nicknamed Maz, he spent his entire 17-year career playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates from 56 to 72. He was elected into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 2001. Mazeroski is regarded as one of the greatest defensive second basemen of all time. He was an all-star for 7 seasons and a Gold Glove Award winner for 8 seasons. He was a key member of the Pirates World Series winning teams in 1960 and 1971, and is perhaps best known for winning the 1960 World Series with a dramatic game-ending home run. While Toronto's Joe Carter, see, there's the connection to Bob. We left Toronto in 1993. When we left, Toronto won the World Series. So this connection between Bill and Toronto puts me in the middle. While Toronto's Joe Carter also hit a series-ending home run in 1993, Mazeroski's home run is the only one to win a World Series Game 7. Amazing. Bill Mazeroski. Hall of Fame selection, other honors. So what is he doing? He did a film cameo in the 1968 Hollywood film The Odd Couple. A lot of people have seen that movie. What is he doing today? Mazeroski serves as a special infield instructor for the Pirates in spring training and retired in Panama City, Florida. He was also in a commercial for FSN Pittsburgh featuring former Pirates first baseman Sean Casey. His son Darren is a retired junior college baseball coach. His son Dave is an atmospheric scientist and did not pursue a career in baseball. He would have been the guest of honor at the first showing in 50 years of the previously lost television footage of Game 7 of the 1960 World Series, but was unable to attend due to hospitalization. He hosts an annual golf tournament, the Bill Mazeroski Golf Tournament. So, he had a pretty relaxed life, didn't he? Dignified life, you could say. Carried on and honored even to today. So, this lost television footage, ooh, is that something I stole? Did I do that? I did say I had the video camera, didn't I? How do we find out about this? Lost footage. Bob tears through Google, learning pattern recognition of the most obscure kind, while people sat breathless in the seat of their pants at what ridiculous pattern will Dobbs come out that will lead to another raucous uproar of laughter and maybe the playing of another Zappa song. That's what we have to look forward to. Television broadcast, 1960. World Series, lost footage. No, it didn't work. World Series. The greatest, isn't that interesting? The greatest scene, they didn't have the footage. Someone stole it.
Wow.
And then they found it. Doesn't seem to be an easy thing to come up with.
I see a YouTube clip, Bob. There's a YouTube clip, but I'm not going to click on it. But it says 1960 World Series Game 7, Yankees versus Pirates.
I mean, I could actually see this moment. I could actually watch it. That would be devastating. Holy shit. I don't want to do it. I don't want to. I want to keep it a strictly radio experience.
Okay.
I want to blow it. I don't know. That's devastating. The Game 7 telecast. Prior to the mid-1970s, television networks and stations generally did not preserve their telecasts of sporting events, choosing instead to tape over them. As a result, the broadcasts of the first six games are no longer known to exist. The lone exception is a black-and-white kinescope of the entire telecast of Game 7, which was discovered in a wine cellar in Bing Crosby's home in Hillsborough, California, December 2009. Bing Crosby and the Mafia stole it. The Rat Pack, the pre-rat, that's the going on the road guy, him and Bob Hope. There's the metaphor. Bob Hope. Bob is our hope. Bob Hope stole it and then stashed it into Bing's home. Let's see. This is worth seeing. The kinetoscope. YouTube. Please. I've got so many things streamed, lined up on my board at the bottom, the bar. There's no room for anything. YouTube. What's the title, Bert?
It says 1960 World Series Game 7, Yankees versus Pirates.
Excellent.
Game 7. So, World Series. If you're watching it, don't say anything. Let me witness this by myself. Okay, 3 hours and 4 minutes. 1 hour and 50. Oh, 2:13. They call it the greatest home run ever. Isn't that awesome? I witnessed the greatest home run with little kids. That's who it's for, right? Man, what a charmed life I lead.
Here's a ball run too high out of Mazeroski.
Okay, this is October 13th. That is Gerd Stern or Don Thiel's birthday. Don Thiel, Gerd Stern, they were born within 24 hours of each other, October 12th, October 13th.
Mm.
3:36 p.m., That would be 4:36 p.m. in Nova Scotia. They're an hour further, closer, beyond Eastern Standard Time. So, yes, the kids be coming home from school. It'll be 4:30. Perfect. Cool fall, leaves have fallen kind of at evening. What the fuck I was doing in Halifax, I have no idea. Here I was managing huge secret council